Okay, welcome. Tonight is March 9th, and tonight is the 15th lecture of the season of Ashkenazic Jewry in the 1500s. And we're just really going to finish off. Last week we started about Amsterdam, Holland, Amsterdam. It was a unique time for the Jews. And I guess really in the course of its 150 years that we are talking, because we're going to be doing, the Jews accomplished a tremendous, tremendous amount. But before the Jews were able to get into Holland, we just went last time that they were excluded, since the Netherlands was really part of Spain, and Spain had just kicked out all their Jews, and they did not allow the Jews to come in. When we talk about Amsterdam, the Netherlands, this is the northern area. It borders to Germany and the North Sea. Across the sea is England. To the south is called the South Place, which was Brussels, Antwerp, which today is Belgium, and then below that is France. Okay, I know we spent a lot of time on the history just to review. It, I guess, really starts for us with Charles V of Germany, who was the Charles I of Spain. And basically, he was one and the same, and he inherited a lot of land from a lot of people. And at one time, he was the most powerful dictator. He was the king of Spain, Sicily, Naples, Sardinia, much of South America, much of North America, and the Netherlands. Why don't I have here Emperor... Emperor of Germany. I'm sorry, I don't know why he's not the... I guess as Charles V, he was the Emperor of Germany. But he was the Emperor of Germany as well. So, on one, this is pretty much what he... One map, this is all his holdings, which was basically most of Europe and Spain, large parts of Italy as well. The next one is also... it shows you what he had gained during his time in the New World, which was South America, North America. And here it just gets a little bit more specific. Orange was what his holdings when he first started to become king, most of Spain. The entire area here he was the emperor of, although directly these orange areas were his, these yellow areas he gained as well. And blue are the enemies. So you could see his main two enemies were France and the Ottoman Empire. Why are we getting into Charles V? Because Charles V, he had the Netherlands really at the time, pretty much after the Spain expulsion of Jews in 1492. So he was the king. In 1519, he became the king of Spain. As king of Spain, he kept... The anti-Jewish or laws that were there, even though he was the king of Germany at the same time, and Germany allowed Jews there, but that's the way he was able to do that. He was able for Germany, he was able to hold Jews there, and in Spain he was not. Anyway, in 1556 he abdicated. He said, "That's it. He wants to move to." Miami, he wants to just take it easy. He wants to learn in Colel.
Miami wasn't.
Huh? Huh? There it is. Yeah, okay. Fine. He had Miami. Right? That was one of his holdings. So that's it. He decided 1556. That's it. He gave it all up. Frederick, his brother, ended up with the Holy Roman Empire as German emperor. And his son, Philip, became the king of Spain. Philip, as the king of Spain, also ended up with the Spanish Netherlands also. Now, at that time in Germany, we mentioned last time, was when Luther, Martin Luther, he was becoming more famous, and Protestantism was becoming a thing. And the church was sort of going on a defense. They had to somehow deal with Luther and Protestantism, and there was... And it was affecting the entire Germany, along with the Netherlands. And they were in particularly affected by a person by the name of Calvin, John Calvin, which was an offshoot of Lutheranism, of Protestantism. So what Philip ended up doing is Philip brought in the Spanish Inquisition into the Netherlands. And basically, he was more successful, just as a review of what we did last week, he was more successful in the south than in the north. So even today, Belgium is a Christian country, but the north, there was a rebellion against Spain, and it ended up that there were seven different William the Silent was one of the leaders of the north at the time. When he was assassinated, his son Moritz of Nassau, who was a general, and there were seven provinces that made up the Netherlands. They got their independence. And really, even though they had their independence, but Spain would not recognize it. And every so often they'd come with armies to try to get back. But finally, in 1648, and this ended the 30-year war in Spain, also dealt with the Netherlands. And finally, at that time, Spain acknowledged the independence of the Netherlands. Okay, that was in 1648. But or much earlier, there are Jews that are going to be moving to the Netherlands, and because there was a tolerance for religion because of the Calvinists, so Jews are going to be able to make their home there.
Calvin was from Germany?
I'm not sure, but he was definitely an influential in the line of Luther, or Martin Luther, whatever his changes that he felt was. So he also, instead of just trying to reform the Catholic Church, they changed. They said, no, we're going to do things different. So exactly what the difference between Calvin and Luther is, I'd have to look into it. Maybe at one point, maybe in the past we did go through it when we did Martin Luther, but I really don't remember. Okay, so now that's the outside. That's nothing to do with the Jews. This was the history in terms of the Netherlands, and finally, in 1648 they finally were recognized. Now just going back. So the communities we mentioned that they started coming in the beginning of the at the end of the 1500s, 1592. There was a boat. There was a boat where it was captured by the English, which at the time was against the Spanish. And there was this girl that some noble was taken in, and the queen got involved, and the queen basically let the whole boat go. And they were the first, Portuguese Muranos that settled in Netherlands. I'm not sure at that point how much they became openness in the Jewishness. But in 1597, we mentioned the last time, there was another group that made their way to. In Germany. To the Emden, the port of Emden. They made up with a Jew. This Jew said, look, I can't teach you anything here because you were baptized. Once you're baptized, then to teach Judaism, you'll be killed, I'll be killed, we'll all be killed, it won't be good. But if you go to Amsterdam, I'll follow you there. And that was the beginning of the Jewish congregation. So then afterwards, Jews from North Africa moved to Amsterdam. And then there was a split in one of the congregations. But over here in 1638, all three of the shuls ended up coming together. They ironed out all the differences, which I guess is something unique for a community, for all Jews. Instead of having three shuls, they all decided to have one shul.
That's unusual.
Yes. They sold off two of the shuls, and they expanded one of the shuls, and they called themselves Kahal Kedushas Talmud Torah. Most of these people that were here were Muranos, were conversos, we should really call them, from Portugal. And this community, since it opened in the very beginning of the 1600s until now, people were coming just about every week, every month. People were coming and joining the community until it numbered a few thousand by the mid 1600s. In 1675, the shul you can go to today, they built this massive shul. I forgot to take down the name of it, but it was a landmark. As a matter of fact, it was a landmark, and the Germans didn't even touch the shul because if things are landmarks, they respected the laws of the host of the countries that they were conquering. The Ashkenazic shul, which was across the street, which is built in 1635, just as old, maybe a little later, 1670s also. We'll see Ashkenazim in a second. That they turned into a stable. That, you know, wasn't a landmark, so they disrespected the shul. But just to show you how the type of community it was, in 1675 they built a new shul. It took 4 years to build at a cost of 186,000 florins. Now, how much is that in today's day? I have no idea. But it seems that it was a massive amount of money for the time. It sat 900 men, 400 women, 12 pillars, and it's still in use today. I don't know what I just did. Why did this happen? That's weird. Oh. Okay. Is it like, did I lose my battery? Okay. I have a feeling I lost my battery. So, because I don't see a blue,
Try it now.
Okay. Right, I just sort of, I guess, took it out and put it back in. So let's see if it works now. Okay. No. Oh, okay. Let's go back. Not working as well. Okay. So the next is Ashkenazim. First Ashkenazim, again, they came in 1635. They were, again, refugees from Europe. But again, most of the Jews, most of the Ashkenazim are going to come in 1648, 1649 from the Chmelnytsky's uprising and the terrible things. As a matter of fact, the one who we, Rav Nosson of Hanover, who wrote the book that we were, you know, the first accounts. Actually, he just stopped in Germany, but there were many people that kept going into Germany and it ended up in Amsterdam. What was by 1674, there were 5,000 Ashkenazi Jewry, even more than the Sephardic Jewry. Although the wealth was in the hands of the Sephardim, and the Ashkenazim were just refugees, and they allowed the Ashkenazim to come, which is also, it says a lot about the Sephardic community, because they Amsterdam would not want to take poor people. You know, you're just going to be a drain on our city. But they were guaranteed by the Sephardim. The Sephardim said, okay, we will sponsor these Jews, we'll take care of them, we'll make sure that they're not a burden on the community. So again to their credit, that's what they did. Okay, in 1671, they had their own great synagogue. That was the shul that the Nazis, you know, just defiled. Okay, just Muranos now is merchants. Muranos, Holland or Amsterdam became a very large merchant city, and they were doing business all over the world. Okay, we're going to discuss about the West Indies. The West Indies Company and the East Indies, and the Jews, what the role the Jews played. But the Sephardim, Portuguese Sephardim, were very well suited to be these types of merchants, because first of all, they were multilingualistic, you know, so they spoke more than one language. A, B, they were well educated. These were mainly Muranos that lived in Portugal. They grew up with a very strong secular education. So they were well versed in the world. They were worldly. They were well educated. They were also well connected with Muranos throughout the world. You know, Landsmen. You know, why not do business with them? The Jews from Portugal, from Spain, they ended up going all over the world. Whether it's the Ottoman Empire, especially in Italy, and they were able to make connections with all throughout the world with other Spanish Portuguese Jews, and that stood very well with the Jews, and that was their main occupation in terms of merchant buying and selling. I don't exactly know what they bought ships and they used them. They hired ships out. Eventually, they became stockholders in the West and East Indies company. Okay, during the 1609 to 1621, it happened to have been a truce. Even though, again, Spain kept fighting with them until 1649, but like there were times when Spain was occupied with fighting other countries, so they had to give a break to Dutch, so they would call it truce. So there was certain times during 1609 to 1621 that they weren't giving, Spain wasn't giving Holland or Amsterdam a hard time, the Netherlands a hard time, so they were able to do more in terms of business. VOC stands for the East Indies Company, and WIC stands for the West Indies Company. VOC is it's a Dutch name. I don't know if I have it here somewhere.
Question: Flemish, yeah. Is that part of the
could be.
Netherlands?
I'm not. I definitely is part of Belgium, so it could have been. I think Dutch is a different language. No, isn't.
I don't know
either, but it's not English. No. Okay. In 1602, the Dutch East Indies Company. Here it is. If you can say that three times.
And, bless you.
Yeah. It was founded. It was the first ever multinational corporation. So one thing about this, it was the first mamish real corporation. What we would call a corporation today, that was the East Indies Company. Because of that, also they needed a financing. So they actually. Dutch or in Amsterdam, they actually made a commercial bank, which probably was also the first true central bank of a country. Which is this was now what they would do is the Dutch they had the East Indies went to the East and the West went to the New World in the West. So what they would do is they accomplished a lot. First of all, they would make ports all through the world, and their boats would go from one port to the other port, the East first. They did a lot of trading in Indonesia, and in India. At some point, they had this is really on the West, so maybe we'll come back to this. They had a trade monopoly with Japan at one point. So they were doing massive amounts of business. And they also, once you have a big corporation, like, one of the things was, like what was hard with other countries doing business with these, like, Indonesia and all the way out the Indies, you needed cash. Because I'm not exactly sure why, but the bartering would not have been enough. So what they were able to do is, they were able to trade within Indonesia from one place to another and then produce cash, Indonesian cash or whatever their cash was, and then buy things and then send it back to Dutch. They had it worked out to a science. They were making a lot of money. It was very, very profitable, and it was right in the East. That was in the East, and a lot of it among it was spices, and at some point there became a spice war with England, with Great Britain. It was a spice war, and to their credit, somehow the Dutch was able to fight off the British. Now, just going back, I remember if you said last week in 1588, because England was helping the Netherlands against Spain. So to help them fight off the Spanish, so Spain didn't like that, and they sent their Spanish armada after England. And if you wanted, the world was changed in that battle. And what ended up happening is the Spanish armada was ruined or destroyed by the English. And after that time, English became the king of the seas. So they were the number one navy. They had, you know, so one of the things was is that they were giving the Dutch a hard time with the East Indies. But, and to the credit of of Amsterdam and the Netherlands, they were able to hold off the attack or the over of Great Britain, and they made some sort of an agreement between them. So the Netherlands and Great Britain and England made a treaty. They made a truce between them. Does anybody know what was part of the result of the treaties? In other words, they said to Netherlands, "Okay, you can have the spice trade." It was called the Spice Wars. You get all the spices, you get the East, but we want something from you, and we'll leave you alone. Does anybody know what that was?
Wouldn't you?
It was New Amsterdam.
New York.
Because of the Spice Wars, so New Amsterdam went from being from Dutch, from England, and it went to England.
Wow.
That was the one of the conditions of the truce. And so I mean the people were there, and the Dutch governor said, "Hey, why should we do this? Let's all revolt." And all the people in New Amsterdam says, "I don't know. England seems to be pretty good. They're pretty stable, you know. We don't mind going anywhere. What's the big deal?" And they just change flags. That's it, you know. And that's it. So, by the way, when you go down to Wall Street, right? You know why Wall Street is called Wall Street?
They had a wall around it.
Because the Dutch had built a wall there to protect from England. That's Wall Street, because that's where the wall around New Amsterdam was. So. And the Dutch paid for it, you know.
It makes sense that that's where the trading is, because that's where.
Wall Street. Yeah. Okay, so that's right. Also, it now with the West in the West, what Dutch did is also an amazing thing. Is a lot of these places in South Africa and South America and North America was conquered by the Portuguese. And they were able, in many cases, to wrest the areas from Portugal to the Netherlands, and they were very, very successful there. Again, they had the shipping down packed. They did not necessarily do a lot of the conquering, but once it was conquered, they would come in and do like the business end of things. I think at one point. Holland had the second biggest army to protect all of their holdings. The Jews, now in the beginning the Jews were not part of it, but at some point the Jews went heavily into the Dutch Indies Company. Jews gradually bought up shares, and by the end of the 17th century became the principal stockholders in Holland, controlling a quarter of the stock of the Dutch East India Company. And it was they also had stock in the West, but that's where it was to show how much money they had there. They wanted to tax the Jews to take care of like the welfare. So what they did is they taxed the Jews' earning in the company, and they used that money to sustain the needy Jews. A communal tax on Jewish shareholders in the East India Company, which was a source of income for the community. So they took that money, and they helped out all the Jews in Amsterdam. I'm not sure if it was the government that said to them, "Listen, you have to take care of your Jews, and where are you going to get your money?" Or it could be the Jews themselves decided, the rabbis of the shul, or the leader of the Jewish communities, the parnassim. There were different leaders of the community that did that. Here's a very interesting letter to Peter Stuyvesant, right? So Peter Stuyvesant was a governor in the New World, which was before it went to New York. So he was a governor for the East, the West Dutch West Indies Dutch Company. So this is their letter back to Peter Stuyvesant. Peter Stuyvesant said, "Look, we don't want Jews here. Don't let Jews settle here." So they answered back Peter Stuyvesant, "We would like to effect and fulfill your wishes and request that the new territories should no more be allowed to be infected by the people of the Jewish nation. For we foresee therefore the same difficulties which you fear. But after having further weighed and considered the matter, we observe that this would be somewhat unreasonable and unfair, especially," I'm not sure what he means by the first part here, "because of the considerable loss sustained by this nation," I don't know if it means the Jews or the Dutch nation, "with others in the taking of Brazil, as also because of the larger amount of capital which they still have invested in the shares of this company." Basically, the company is owned by Jews, and the Jews are not going to say that the Jews can't settle in the new land. "We would have liked to invested in the shares of this company," "Therefore, after many deliberations, we finally decided and resolved to annotate upon a certain petition presented by the said Portuguese Jews that these people may travel and trade to in the new Netherlands and live and remain there, provided the poor among them shall not become a burden to the company or to the community, but be supported by their own nation." Again, you know, they, okay, "you will now govern yourself accordingly. Letter from the Dutch East India Company to Governor Peter Stuyvesant." So I'm not sure why this was part of East and West. I guess I'm not sure. I guess it was the East India Company. It should have been the West. Maybe West was just South America. I'm not sure. So I don't know which was which.
Bigger of the two.
It could be. East was definitely bigger, but it could be that, no, West was 1621, so it was around also. Okay, in South America, it seems that the Jews that came to South America came there because of the Dutch East India Company, that they asked for Jews to come, Jews went to settle there, the relations between the Dutch and South America were established by Jews. They contributed to the establishment of the Dutch West Indies Company in 1621. Okay, and some of them were members. There was a Portuguese captain who said to have Jewish relations in Holland. Some years afterwards, Dutch and Brazil appealed to Holland for craftsmen of all kinds. So this is Brazil. This is in the beginning. Many Jews went to Brazil. About 600 Jews left Amsterdam in 1642, accompanied by two distinguished scholars. These were Chasheva Rabbanim, Isaac Aboab da Fonseca and Moses Rafael de Aguilar. In the struggle between Holland and Portugal, of course, for the possession of Brazil, the Dutch were supported by the Jews. They wanted, of course, they were part of the Jewish, the Dutch East India Company, and they wanted the... okay, then there was a question, there was some sort of council or whatever of different nations. What do we do about, you know, I guess they made like international law at the time, because you had Portugal, you had Spain, you had Holland, you had England. You know, what do we do in terms of back and forth? So the question was are the Jews also included in this peace agreement? And the Spanish, of course, the Spanish king refused. And in 1657, again, the Jews were subject. In 1650, if the Jews want to do something, they could send a lawyer, but they can't come set foot on the ground. In 1657, Holland said, "Okay, they're no longer just Jews, but they're citizens of Holland. So, like, you know, then don't treat them like Jews; treat them like citizens of Holland." And Holland got. In terms of France, France just said, like, you know, come on. Like, they went to the Dutch minister, "What are you doing? What are you being so nice to the Jews for?" You know, that's... Now, based on all this, now comes England. So at this point, you had Oliver Cromwell, who was the protectorate of England. He realized in his short time that he was the protectorate, that the Jews would be a very good asset to England, and one of the things was is the international trade, and he correctly understood that Holland's the Netherlands' success in international trade had a large part of it was the Jews, and he therefore wanted a piece of the pie, and he wanted Jews to come into England. Cromwell was desirous of attracting Jews to England. To the, okay, so he started with Menashe ben Israel. So just the next part of it. Okay, just the things after 1730. Basically, if you want to keep the leader in international trade, you have to do things like take money and reinvest it, and be cutting edge and doing things. And that's not what England did. That's not what Dutch did. And other countries, you know, Dutch had monopolies in certain areas, and they had the ports in certain areas. So people had to rely on Dutch, the Dutch boating, you know, the East Company to get their stuff. What other countries did is they opened up their own ports, so they didn't need the Dutch. Secondly, is the Dutch, they didn't upgrade. They didn't get modern, they didn't modernize, and they weren't. And third is they didn't reinvest the money. They took the money and they lent it to other countries. You know, I guess loaning money out, they became more banking. And because of that, in the 1730s, whatever, the Dutch became not as great as they were before. That's, you know, so the Dutch, that was the height time in the mid-1600s. Okay. Menashe, there was a person by the name of Menashe ben Yisrael, a very, very talented, unbelievable person. He was born as a Marano in 1604. They moved to the Netherlands in 1610. He was a rabbi, but also a printer. He opened up the first printing press. He was a scholar, and he wrote many, many svarim. He was also a Rosh Yeshiva. He did a lot of things. He was the head of the community, so he opened up a printing press, and a lot of it was for himself. But this Amsterdam printing press became the printing press for the Jews for the next like 200 years, because in other places there were a lot of censors, and it was the Christians ran it, and it was hard to get things printed. But the printing press in Amsterdam was known as the best quality and the easiest in terms of censors and everything. So if somebody really wanted to get their work done, they would bring it to Amsterdam to get it done there. It was opened by this Menashe ben Israel. His most famous book that became internationally famous was a book called El Consolador. He wrote this book. I'm not sure if it was in Latin or in Spanish, but he wrote it to reconcile apparent discrepancies in different parts of the Hebrew Bible. He didn't only quote Jewish sources; he quoted non-Jewish sources. Why did he write this book? It was for Moranos, to give them chizuk, to show them that the Old Testament is real. There's nothing wrong with it. You have questions that so I'll answer your questions. You know, so therefore he had no problems quoting other priests and other scholars about the, because his purpose was for the Moranos to realize that the Torah, that the Old Testament or the Torah, is real. He did things which made his printing press the best. It changed several owners, but he always remained connected to it. Okay, again, this is what I said. Aim primary to strengthen the face of the Moranos. Okay? These are some of his other svarim that he wrote. The Terminio de Vieta, written in Latin. Some of these, Nishmas Chaim, he wrote in Hebrew. This is about the immortality of the soul, about the neshama. What happens about reincarnation, that one. There was also a book. It says over here. He was an acquaintance with Rembrandt. So I think in the museum over there they have a picture. I think they say it may have been Rembrandt who painted Menashe ben Yisrael's picture. He definitely painted the Chacham Tzvi. He also thought that, but there was one book that he wrote, which was, I'm not sure which one of these it is, or if it's on this book. Okay, we're going to get to this book. He wrote a book for Moranos coming to Amsterdam. Now you have to realize these Moranos were brought up Christian. They only kept Judaism in private. They didn't have any yeshivas and anything. So when they came to Amsterdam, it was a big culture change. You had to move from Christianity to Judaism in the open, what was right, what was wrong. So Menashe ben Israel, he wrote out like a guidebook for them. And it was a very popular book. It was actually reprinted many years later, second printing, and it was very helpful for these Maranos to help them make the transition. This book, Hope of Israel. So okay, he says he was moved to Brazil for a short time, but that didn't, when he became a rabbi. Okay, starting in 1644. Now this is the story that has to do with England. He met somebody who was in South America who swore to him that the South American Andes Indians were descendants of the 10 lost tribes. He says, I'm swearing to you that they came from the 10 tribes and they do things that Shvatim did. So when Menashe ben Israel heard this, he said, he had an understanding that in order for Mashiach to come, you needed Jews in all four corners of the world. And Jews were everywhere except for England. They weren't in England. They were in South America. There was North America. South America, you know, they had all these Indians, you know, so they had all the 10 tribes are there, and so every place except for England. So now he had a mission. He wanted Israel to be, England to accept Israel. And he was a famous personage. He was known throughout the world. So what he did is he wrote this book, Mikvah. What did I say? The Mikvah, Hope of Israel, and he printed it there to try to convince the Christians to allow the Jews, because it could be they were also into this. I'm not sure that they wanted their Messiah to come, and they had to have Jews all over. Now, what happened, the hope of Israel stretched to the hope that Jews would return to England as a way of hastening the coming of Mashiach. That's really what he wanted. Oliver Cromwell, at the same time, wanted Jews to come. Now, Oliver Cromwell, King Charles I was beheaded, and they chose Oliver Cromwell to become the protectorate of England. And so it wasn't a monarchy, although he was almost like a king. And he wanted Jews to come for a variety of reasons. I don't know if I have it over here. So what they did is they asked Menashe ben Israel to come and plead the case, apply that the Jews should be able to come. He wasn't able to at first. He sent his son. Then I don't know if a war broke out or he got sick. And eventually he did come and he pleaded his case. And it was, he writes about in his book why England should, everybody accepts the Jews, and wherever the Jews go, the country flourishes. That's what he was sending to England. Oliver Cromwell himself, he foresaw the importance of English commerce. England had already given Jews full rights in one of their colonies in Suriname. I'm not sure where that is. He also believed that they could be great in foreign intelligence. The English Secret Service. What do they call it? MI6. So this would be the forerunners of MI6. The Jews, and he believed that it would improve trade. He saw the Jews as an important part of the Amsterdam's financial success, and he wanted that for England as well. Okay. Now, again, one of the questions. Now, there was this Whitehall conference. So Oliver Cromwell called this conference with all the people that were necessary to try to get them to agree that the Jews could move to England. And basically, and Menashe ben Israel, I think, actually came there. I don't know if he pleaded his case, but his book was there. And that's what this was, the push to get the Jews accepted. Now, in reality, it wasn't accepted. And Oliver Cromwell, once he realized that the Jews were not going to be accepted, he just, instead of them, posketing they can't come, he just dissolved the entire conference. However, something very, very important came out of that conference, and that is that the Jews were expelled in 1290 by the king. Okay, but the only thing is, so they had to decide, when the king expelled them, was that English law? The Jews could not live there, or the king did it on his own? you know, Chakira did he do it on his own, or was it English? So they paskined in this Whitehall conference, which was huge, is that there's no English law that said that Jews can't live in England. And when they were thrown out, they were thrown out by the king on his own. He felt that's it. He didn't want to protect the Jews anymore. All Jews have to leave. But there was no law saying that the Jews were kicked out. Unlike, let's say, Spain, when the Spanish expulsion was, the Jews are not allowed to live here. But that was huge. What then happened is, so this, but they didn't come up and say that the Jews can now live here. And you see, this is one of these things in history where it looks like it was the worst thing for the Jews, a bad thing, but it ended up being the best thing for the Jews. Shortly happened, there were Muranos there, and shortly afterwards, England went into war with Spain. And these Muranos were these Spanish-born, and they were told that they had to leave. So they said, "We're not longer Spanish, we're Jews." They put on the yarmulkes, and they started acting like Jews, right? So when they did that, they did get some sort of verbal agreement or assurance, a promise from Oliver Cromwell that they won't be thrown out. So now you had these Muranos acting like Jews, so you had a core of Jewish families there. Okay, so now you had that it's not illegal for Jews to live in England, and you had a core of Jews that were living there. And the reason why is... this is also an interesting case. Robles was a Spanish, Murano, and then when they confiscated all his stuff, he said, "I'm not Spanish, I'm Jewish, so give it all back to me." So, I don't know if they gave it back to him, but that's how he petitioned the return of his seized property on account that he's of the Hebrew nation rather than Spanish. "I'm not Spanish, I'm Jewish, so give me my stuff back." So that's what, But Cromwell said, "Look." Basically, Cromwell said to these Jews, "Just open up your shul. You want a cemetery? We'll give you a cemetery." And I guess they had some sort of assurances that the army won't come and lock them up or kill them or whatever. So they were living there without a permit to live there. But they were, they were just there. They didn't have a on the laws, they were not allowed to live. They didn't say you can, but they didn't say you can't. The reason why it was so fortunate is because Cromwell died in 1660, and his son or somebody else took over for another year or two. And then after that, England wanted their king back. So I think it was Charles II, the son of Charles who was beheaded, he became the king again. And one of the things he did was he pretty much undid all of the things that Oliver Cromwell had done. So if he had this on the books, they changed that. And if he had this, made this law, they changed that. So they really undid a lot of what Oliver Cromwell had done. Had he got the conference to say it's legal for the Jews to come into England, it's highly likely that the king would have said it's illegal for the Jews to come in England. They would have undone what Oliver Cromwell did. So it's like, you see how Hashem works things out. Not only that, but because they weren't an official community, they weren't taxed. So for a long time, they didn't have to pay taxes until at some point England said, okay, officially the Jews are allowed to live here and move here. When Menachem ben Israel died, he thought he died as a failure. He thought that he was unsuccessful in getting the Jews to be able to go back to England, which in fact, he was very successful. He really didn't realize how successful he was. The Jews, as a matter of fact, okay, and the Jews had moved to England, and they would continue living there. And in World War II, World War I, we're going to see they play a large part of World War I, and a place to go for World War II. I guess we'll stop here. So we're going to have to come back to Amsterdam next year, because we have to talk about, there's a machlokas big between Jonas and Eibeschitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden. It has to do with Amsterdam. So again, this I guess would end it this year, where we started in Germany in the 1500s with Rabbi Yosselman of Rosheim, and basically we went into Poland, to the golden age of Poland, ending with 1648, 1649, Gzeiras Tachvatati, the massacres of Chmelnytsky, and then just the last two, we started with Amsterdam, Holland. So next year, I guess we probably will start off with the Shabtai Tzvi, and I think Shabtai Tzvi is going to be like one of these watersheds in history, because the Jewish nation is not going to be the same before as after. And thank you so much. This was a wonderful for me. I learned so much, and I hope you did too. And okay, thank you very, very much.